comments. It was so nice. Week one, we've got to do it twice. I'm Charlotte Henry, and joining me, as ever, is the lovely Emma Bennett. How are you, Emma?
I'm very well, Charlotte.
In fact, I'm going to tell our listeners how you are, because Emma's too polite to say it. Emma is bloody exhausted. Emma is rehearsing her play. I turned on our Zoom to hit record on this, and I was like, oh, Emma's worked very hard on this today. And it's only the first day of rehearsals, so I'm really excited to see you on the last night of the performance and see how far you've made it.
Honestly, we've added an extra performance on the last day. So we're doing two performances on the Saturday. By the end of the second one, I'm just going to be like, all of my friends from like school, from secondary school, are coming on the Saturday night, and like will probably want to go out for dinner with me, and I'll be like, okay,
I'll scraping you along the floor, yeah,
on the table.
Someone get that girl a very stiff drink.
Well,
you might by the end of Saturday. And frankly, I need a stiff drink after sitting through.
Can anyone afford to drink anymore?
Well, in fact, that's normally a budget thing, isn't it? Alcohol taxes. We didn't have that today, but we did have a lot of other stuff in the autumn statement. Now, you and I both started our conversation going, oh, wasn't that depressing? And I suspect that we found it depressing for very different reasons. Now, I found it depressing because I was watching it all. I was watching Jeremy Hunt. I was watching Rachel Reeves' response. I was going, what is the point in this? What is the point in these two parties? What actually do they believe now? What is the point of them? What do they think about stuff that's in any way different? And I always used to actually be really unimpressed with people that said stuff like that. And actually now I sort of get it. You've now had both parties go through the process of having people who are not fit to lead them. You've now got the grown-ups, quote unquote, back in. Managerial technocracy, if that's the word, is back in vogue. And like, bleh, is my main response to all of it. Just like, what do any of you believe in? What's the point of any of you? You could merge into I was going to say purple party, but that means something different in the UK, doesn't it? That's a sort of UKIP colour. But you know what I'm saying. It could sort of, the centres of both parties now, that managerial centre could sort of blur into each other.
I think there is a difference between managerial socialism and managerial hyper-capitalism. I think...
Yeah, but we didn't even see hyper-capitalism. We saw blur.
We saw the more blur than Liz Truss, but that doesn't mean that they're not enacting things that are deeply right-wing. Well, I think they're raising taxes to pay off debt, but what they're not doing is investing in the state as a system, they are managing the politics of some of the austerity they're doing by not having by raising benefits, but they've squeezed who gets those benefits so much over the last 12 years that they can probably afford to do that because they're still deeply ungenerous. The people on those benefits will still feel the effects of everything else going up around them. And they've, of course, given money away to pensioners again.
Oh, yeah, we'll come on to that because, yes, we'll come back to that.
But I think I don't mind managerialism if what you're doing is managing two different visions. I think the Tories are a bit trapped because they were trying... They are trying not to have a vision, essentially.
I agree with that.
So I think there is a vision, more vision, on the Labour side. It's not everything I would ever
want.
That's because I'm considerably to the left of the Labour leadership.
And also we should say... We should say that actually in opposition, 2 years out from a general election, you do have a bit of a right not to put all your cards on the table. I do accept that.
But I do think there is a different approach. And part of the opposition's job at this point is to say the reason that we're stuck in this completely appalling situation is not just the last 6 weeks, it is the last 12 years. And to tie this as much as anything to George Osborne's austerity that is suddenly back in fashion, to Liz Truss's insanity.
Okay, so there's a few things I want to pick up there. But first, let's look at the actual numbers, because you sort of implied there was no, or it could be perceived that there was no new money going to the state. And that's really not true. Jeremy Hunt said, and this is a quote directly from his speech, "I will increase the NHS budget in each of the next 2 years by an extra £3.3 billion. That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money to you and me. It's a drop in the ocean to the NHS. And then when you think about the...
The additional costs
that are going to the NHS, like, for example, energy costs of running a hospital, which are insane.
Sure.
It's not a real times spending increase.
And then there's also a record £8 billion package for our health and care social system. Government putting the NHS first was his phrase. I have a problem with all this stuff because genuinely you and I could sit here and read out these numbers. And the truth is, you and I don't know how many zeros we would need to put into this system. The truth is the NHS has, for, you know, it does some things very well. It does some things particularly badly, as anyone who's tried to get a GP appointment at 8 o'clock in the morning will know. But, you know, there is a huge amount of money going in. I think there was extra money for some of the devolved institutions, you know, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, and so on. Anyway, so there was that. And, you know, my point about it all being the same, which, again, I've always tried to reject for quite a number of years, and I'm quite disappointed in myself. I found myself in this place. You know, how much, if Rachel Reeves had stood up and delivered the autumn statement, which, you know, she might well be doing in a couple of years' time, what number would she have put in that? An extra X billion? Like, we don't know, but it probably is in a not different well. And let's, your point also about it's been caused by 12 years of Conservative-led governments. Now, of course, that we've seen this with so many different cycles where governments of both parties have been in power for a relatively long period of time. Eventually, everyone gets fed up with you and everything can be blamed on you and you can't keep chucking it to the other party. And, so, you know, the coalition had the benefit for at least a couple of years and maybe a bit longer of trying to lob everything back to the Labour government. Some of it was true, some of it was pushing its luck. This is, you know, and now 12 years into Conservative-led governments, obviously, that's obviously going to be the Labour line. We know, just as there was in, frankly, between 2008 and 2010, there's lots of global factors playing into things as well. All, you know.
Yes and no. Again, yes, there are global headwinds, but we came into those headwinds weakened by the position we were already in. And that, I think, is the point that is often missed in these conversations. It's not just Brexit, though that's a factor.
Well, I definitely want to come back to that as well, because it was the one thing no one mentioned on either side of, on either bench.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that I think is starting to become completely unsustainable. And it's interesting. A lot of the mood music elsewhere is suddenly being more accepting a conversation of Brexit, so you might get a bit more courage from the Labour benches to actually talk about it. But it's also the factors that there was an awful lot of, oh, we're going to cut all the waste, and what they meant was the capacity for expansion. So when we were in the 2010 to 2015 Cameron era government, they kept cutting things and going, but look, everything's working fine as normal. And that's because we were in normal. But the problem with that is there wasn't that sense that not everything's going to be normal all the time. So then when we went into crisis, there just wasn't that headroom to be able to expand into crisis. And that was what was missing in that thinking.
And look, this is perhaps the biases that you and I told, having, I don't think I'm revealing any secrets to say that we both voted Remain and were pretty disappointed, to put it mildly, at the result of that referendum. But that, you know, I wrote a piece saying it has to be respected, and, you know, that is how it works in democracy. sometimes the side you're on loses. But it's interesting. So I've got Jeremy Hunt's speech up. How many times do you think he mentioned the word Brexit in his entire speech, which must have been a good 45 minutes to an hour?
Twice.
Once. There is one sentence in there that uses the phrase Brexit, and it was so today, using our Brexit freedoms, I confirm the next step in our supply side transformation. That was it. Rachel Reeves didn't mention it. Jeremy Hunt mentioned it once. It's pretty pathetic, isn't it?
It is, because it is the biggest thing about our economy. We are currently having a massive row about whether the Australian trade deal we did was any good. And it's like there's this parallel universe that Parliament is sitting in where none of this is being discussed. And part of the reason that we Brexited was because loads of people felt that there was a parallel universe that Parliament was sitting in where no one was talking about issues around the EU.
Right, right. And now we're back. Yeah, yes, it's true. We're now back in the parallel universe where no one is talking about the EU. And you can make a case for some things that Brexit has afforded us. The only one I can really think of that I think has any credibility is the speed of the vaccine rollout. The EU did eventually catch up, but obviously not being, and we could have, I believe, within the, even if we had been in the EU, chosen to run our own vaccine program. I believe that is right. But the likelihood of that happening, I would imagine, is slim. And so you can just, I'm prepared to give the vaccine rollout is about the only Brexit win I can think of. Now, it's a big, significant thing, but there are lots of day-to-day things clearly affecting our economy that we're not talking about because no one can say the B word.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not a reasonable state to be in politics. No. And Brexiteers aren't talking about it because it's not going very well.
Mm-hmm.
But Labour people aren't talking about it because they still feel like they have to be
so it sort of rips the party in two, doesn't it?
Remain, which they are. You say it breaks the party in two, but actually, like 80-90% of Labour members were Remainers, basically, and then the very small core of Lexiteers. It's just that it was used as a tool in the other factional divisions in the party.
Yeah, I wasn't actually necessarily talking about the membership, because I think, I mean, you'll know better than me, but that sounds right, how you're describing the membership. I was thinking sort of in the constituencies that Labour needs to win back.
I mean, this is the thing. A lot of Labour constituencies voted for Brexit.
Right.
But even within that, there's some quite interesting numbers that will tell you that the Labour vote in those constituencies, because it skews younger, actually is more Remain than the constituencies themselves.
Interesting. Okay, I see what you're saying. Yep.
So
the people that vote Labour in those constituencies probably voted Remain, is what you're saying.
Yes, although not completely, because it's never going to map totally. And there is a group of people in those constituencies who are probably the swing voters that will make a difference. So they do, Labour are right to try and court them. I'm just not sure that the way to court them is to never talk about what has gone wrong post-Brexit. And I don't think the answer is Labour going, hey, we're going to get back in tomorrow and it will all be fine. Not least because I can't imagine the EU are going, yeah, totally going to have you back any second.
Yeah, and the terms.
Same deal you used to have.
Yeah, and the terms we would re-enter on are just not.
So that's not
acceptable.
So Labour needs to be like, I understand that they do the, we've got to make Brexit work. And I understand that pisses off ultra Remainers on Twitter, the FBPE crowd, but that's kind of the price you pay. They need to have that conversation rather than saying we've had that conversation, now we've moved on. Because what they keep doing is saying we've had that conversation rather than having that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I see what you're saying. Yep. There's a couple of other bits of this autumn statement that I want to pick up on. I should say, as depressed as I am, it wasn't quite as dour as I thought it was going to be, which is perhaps shows how low the bar I had set was as opposed to anything else. It is. I did think it's pretty
much. I can't afford to lose 7% of my living standards.
Well, quite so, but. You know, I was talking more in terms of the delivery, like it was all shoved.
I think that was always going to be the case. They were lining us up to cheer us up.
Yes, perhaps.
You know, that's classic political management. And they weren't, they made it very clear they weren't going to do that with a policy. So they just did it with tone. And okay, politics may be very vibes based these days, but even so, I'm not actually cheered up by going, hey, everything's all right. You'll be fine with 7% less than you've got now.
Yeah. Well, we do also have to, you know, I accept that we have to see how some of it plays out in reality, but if you read through the speeches without the presentation, it's not exactly encouraging stuff. I'm trying to be positive before I come back to grumbling. I wanted to pick out a couple of good lines from each of them. I thought the recession, Jeremy Hunt described it as a recession made in Russia, was not a bad line in the circumstances. I thought that was pretty well delivered. I also did like Rachel Reeves's impression of the sting and the police towards the end of her response when she was sort of doing her version of, I'll be watching you, and she turned it into they'll be taxing you, which, as laughable as it is for a Labour Party to be complaining about high taxes, she pulled it off pretty well. A line I really did not like was Jeremy Hunt, I think a couple of times, referring to the UK as the next Silicon Valley. Now, I cover tech quite a lot, and this isn't a nonsense line. It is not a nonsense line because there's no tech talent in the UK. There is huge amounts of technology talent in the UK. It's a nonsense line because people have been saying it for goodness knows how many years, from when we were trying to make Old Street a hub in London of tech talent and innovation. Anyway, it's a nonsense line because no one's actually, like, the facilities are there. Like, we do have fantastic universities. We do have a leading finance centre. There is stuff that you could do to, on a perhaps smaller scale, replicate what happens in Silicon Valley. But first of all, I'm not entirely, and this perhaps says something about my worldview, I'm not entirely sure it is in the gift of the government to decide, click their fingers and decide that. You know, these things tend to happen quite naturally. And I just think we've been hearing this stuff for so long. And if the government does think it's in its gift and it is able to do this stuff, well, it's been quite a long time where it hasn't done it, and British tech has been getting on with it by itself. So I thought that was a bit of a nonsense line. One thing I think
it's a nonsense line for a lot of reasons. Silicon Valley is not as big. I mean, I know California is a lot bigger than like Britain, I think. Texas certainly is. But Silicon Valley isn't. And we've got the Silicon Roundabout in Old Street, but I think that's quite the same thing.
Well, it was meant to replicate the model of having a hub where the, you know, it was next to the city. They were meant to have lots of companies and startups, you know, startup co-working space. The idea was that there would be a hub in central London, and to an extent, that kind of thing has worked. But as I say, it's not entirely in the gift of the government.
It doesn't do what is actually needed in our economy, which is to take away the massive agglomeration that happens in London and to actually disperse those sorts of industries so that we have what we used to have, which was, you know, Northampton being the absolute centre of hat making. I think it's hat making, Northampton. It might be shoes.
I think you're right about Northampton and hats, because I think Northampton town are known as the Hatters.
There you go. There's another place whose team is called the Cobblers, and they do shoes, but I can't remember where that is or which football team it is. But I know that that is the case. Anyway.
Sorry, we're both wrong. This is a disgrace for me.
Is it Norwich?
The Hatters are Luton Town.
Luton. Oh, Luton. Oh, gosh, I'd known that. My mum was born.
What a disgrace I am.
And you know football, so I'm blaming you. Anyway. The idea that the whole of the UK is going to be...
Cobblers and Northampton Town, you were right the first time.
Thank you. Is going to be Silicon Valley doesn't actually talk to what is needed for the UK-wide economy and the actual dispersal of that agglomeration.
I mean, it is obviously true that you need different industries to flourish in different places, and you can't just have London as the only economic centre of the country. That is obviously true. There are good reasons why tech in particular would be centred around London, but we also see huge, because of the universities, innovation, you know, around Cambridge and Oxford as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But all of which is in the Southeast and London. Sure. And, you know, one of our reasons for being a low productivity economy is that we've only overheated one corner of it. And I'm not saying tech is bad. I'm not saying investment in tech is bad. I'm saying if you stand up at the dispatch box and saying tech is the place that we're going to focus our energies, what you are saying is we are going to focus our monies on London and the Southeast and Cambridge and Oxford. And I don't think, given that we're talking about very difficult choices, those are the places that need that help most.
That was what the whole levelling up agenda was about, wasn't it? One interesting part of tech is that video game. I mean, we don't need to go too deep down this rabbit hole. Video games was one of the parts of tech that, as I understand it, was always not London centric.
Yeah, no, there's a very big hub in Nottingham and another in Glasgow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's huge games. And Britain is, you know, a fantastic exporter of video game talent. So it's not only that, but anyway, I think there's two separate points. One, you can have London as a tech hub in the UK, but you are right, and that you can't have every industry focused around London. There's, you know, other places around the country have expertise in things that they should also be supported. That is self-evidently correct.
So at the same time, the government are trying to force that Chinese company who bought the big microchip factory in, is it Wrexham? Somewhere up that way.
Right.
To resell. They're basically saying you cannot own this thing in the UK. It's a security risk.
Well, there's always been a huge, huge ongoing row, which we could do a whole episode on, and wasn't actually.
But there are, possibly, I mean, there
about
are
Huawei
technologies that we could. But it's the manufacturing, and I think the problem is when the government says we're going to invest in tech,
it means sexy startups.
It's sexy startups and things being incubated in universities and being pushed out from them. What we don't think of is medium-sized factories in places like Bolton or Wrexham or Derby. Yeah.
Making specialist hardware.
Making specialist components.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
That is what I think needs to be more focused on, but I don't think that's what Jeremy Hunt is talking about.
No, there's an ongoing issue with American tech companies that there's not a lot of stuff. Some of them are trying to fix it, but not a lot of stuff is manufactured in the USA or predominantly. I've got another thing, Emma, that I think you and I are going to agree about.
Oh, God.
I know, don't worry. Well, I think there is a window for you to disagree with me, but I want to talk about the windfall tax because it's one of the only tax rises that I actually agree with. They've extended it and pushed it, and I think the narrative with which they did so was completely right. You know, these are not profits due to natural innovation and improving your company and providing a brilliant service that people want so you make big revenue and profits. They are essentially the profits of war, and therefore, given that we are part of the war effort to support Ukraine, and quite rightly so, that money should go, a windfall tax is a legitimate way to take that, for want of a better phrase, profits of war, and to put it into the British war effort.
Absolutely. Tax burden should be largely shifted on things that are unearned, that do not come through effort, labour and innovation. That the shift of the burden, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have any income tax or any company tax on small startups or anything, but I'm saying that the burden should be on land and wealth and unearned income.
How very Liberal Democrat of you.
No, I think you'll find land value tax has long been a socialist policy.
There's big plans in the Lib Dems of it as well. Here's what Jeremy Hunt did and said is he has decided that from January 1st until March 2028, so quite a big, so from January 1st, 2023 to March 2028, so five and a bit-ish years, the energy profits levy, i.e. what we all call the windfall tax, is going to go from 25% to 35%. There was a bit of a weird thing that we seem to be taxing electric vehicles. Couldn't quite get my head around that, but I guess it just brings in some money.
Electric vehicles is separate, isn't it? Like they're playing road tax in a way that they weren't previously.
Correct, that's correct. And it was one of the big ways to try and sell electric, convert people over to electric vehicles, that you reduce their tax burden.
Presumably you don't have to convert them anymore because all vehicles are now going to be.
Yeah, sure. So maybe that is the justification. I also quite...
They still go on roads that need fixing, so...
Sure.
If they're
going to become the majority of vehicles, yeah. I also thought the way Jeremy Hunt framed it, as I said, was quite good. He said, I have no objection to windfall taxes if they are genuinely about windfall profits caused by unexpected increases in energy prices. And that is completely fair, isn't it? And the point is, we also know what is calling the unexpected increases in energy prices. We know what that is about.
Yeah, absolutely. What I would like, if they're doing this for 5 years, I would like to see the immediate profits of the income of that being put towards the things that we need now. But actually, maybe for the last 3 years, that should be put into investment in things that help with energy security, such as energy infrastructure, building more wind farms. The new British Energy that the Labour government that we'll have by that point will be setting up. Things that will actually have a long-term impact.
Yeah, I think also by doing this politically, because you sort of secure continuing public support for the efforts in Ukraine and the British support for them. Because what they're obviously, and I guess this is part of what Putin is wanting on a grander scale, is that the public in the various countries being hit by large energy price rises will go, this is not our war.
Yeah, yeah.
Putin isn't bulldozing our cities. Why are we paying for this?
Yeah, that's
and you get a very isolationist form,
which does not seem to have come to fruition
yet. But you know, we're going into
into a harsh winter. So
I think economically it is correct, and politically it is fair, and achieves quite a lot of things. Right. Any more you want to do on this before we get on to another deeply depressing topic?
I mean, I think in terms of the politics, the Tories have really had nowhere else to go. They've delivered the budget they had to deliver, but already you've got their own backbenchers, including Jacob Rees-Mogg, attacking elements of this.
Esther McVeigh wasn't very happy either, was she?
Esther McVeigh's not happy. Jacob Rees-Mogg's not. So they've still got the political problem they had yesterday. They are still a Tory party that cannot hold itself together. They'll probably get the budget through. An 80-seat majority is still an 80-seat majority, even though I think it's actually more like a
70. Yeah, he's pushing 70-something now, though. But yes, you're right. It's big enough.
They'll get it through, but that doesn't mean that the dissent years are over.
No, it doesn't mean that. And it also doesn't mean that this... I go back to my original point before we move on, that I'm not really sure if this is what a Conservative government is delivering. Correct. I just don't really get the point. Anyway, that is amongst the reasons I'm not a member of the Conservative Party. Anyway, let's talk. And I never thought I'd say this to you on anything we recorded or indeed anything we discussed in public. Let's discuss football, Emma Bunnell. Because
massive football fan.
Yeah, yes. Well, despite me disgracing myself by not being able to remember the nicknames of lower league teams, I am a big football fan and normally cannot wait for a World Cup. And by the time you're listening to this, it'll be 2 days out. You might have already started, you'll be listening to this once the World Cup has started. I'm just not feeling the vibe at all. And part of that is because it's a very weird part of the season. It's normally a summer thing. But a large part of it is down to the host nation, the very depressing kind of play. I mean, we could do, as I say, for a few things, we could do a whole conversation about FIFA and its grotesqueness as an organisation. But equally, there is something just so depressing about, you know, football has done quite a lot of work to improve LGBT rights and, how it respects LGBT fans, even though we don't really have top tier players coming out yet in the men's game. Obviously, things are very, very different in the women's game. But then we're shipping the whole World Cup and the world's greatest players to Qatar. I mean, listeners won't need us to recount the problems with the LGBT rights and Qatar. We have also had thousands of deaths building the shiny new stadia that we will be watching during the World Cup. And let me be honest with you, just because I'm feeling pretty despondent that it's in Qatar, there is absolutely no doubt that I'm going to be watching loads of the games and spending hours taking it in because I just can't help myself. And to pretend I wouldn't be watching, I won't be watching it. Deep.
That's not a political stance, that's because I don't.
Right, it's...
England get into a semi.
It's just deeply disingenuous for me to pretend otherwise, but it's all just a bit... It just feels a real shame that something, you know, there was problems in the final, but there's been really nice occasions where people have got behind the England team.
Yeah.
There was the joy of the women winning the Euros, which was just wonderful. And this just feels really miserable.
It feels really miserable. I think there are a number of reasons why it hasn't caught fire. Some of them are the political things that we've been talking about. Some of it's just the time of year. People are actually, they're looking forward to December. And I remember watching the women's final, because I do watch it when England get into like a semi-final. Yeah. That's about it. And I had all my windows open and so did all my neighbours. And you could hear everyone roaring. Yep. And that's not going to happen at this time of year.
No.
That kind of shared experience, even if it's just us all watching from our flats, but roaring and you can all hear it on the street. That's not going to happen. There's no one going to be sitting in Trafalgar Square freezing their nuts off watching it.
No. The scenes we always see from pub gardens.
None of that. But also, they're just, you know, I haven't seen a single flag of St George on someone's car or anything like that.
No.
It just doesn't feel like World Cup season at all.
No, it will be interesting to see if some of that gets going as the games start. And I imagine it will.
It probably will. It'll be competing with tinsel, though, which it doesn't usually have
to. Yeah.
It feels very, very dampened. One of the things that I wanted to raise, and I want to do this in the right way, because I don't want anyone to think that I'm trying to diminish the problems of LGBT rights in Qatar, because they are really...
You're not doing a James Cleverly on us.
I wouldn't even know what that means. But
well, he was a bit like...
Yes, I do know what you mean. Yeah. No, not at all. I think it's really good that lots of people are raising that issue with Qatar and saying you must, you should change this. And we should remember that Muslim men, and generally men, I believe, who are discovered to be homosexual in Qatar are put to death. What I... I'm slightly nervous about is that in putting that front and center of the conversation, we are losing the prominence of the workers' rights that have been highlighted or should have been highlighted much more in this conversation. You know, it's estimated that 6,500 people have died building the infrastructure and stadium that was needed to put on the World Cup in Qatar. 6,500 people. And that's, you know, that's an astonishingly appalling number. And
normally they're migrant, really very poor migrant workers.
We find it far easier to talk about the rights of LGBT and particularly white LGBT visiting fans than we do the Muslim migrant workers coming in from poorer African countries.
So first of all, you're completely right to raise once again the issue of the migrant workers. As you say, it's over 6,000 that have died and it's just abysmal. I would say that there has been quite in-depth coverage and investigations on that. That is how we know the number. Should we keep talking about it? Yes, absolutely. As we watch those lovely stadiums and the games in them, we need to remember how they were built.
Yeah, they're soaked in blood. Every time you look at that stadium, you should see the...
There was a very powerful front page that you may be able to see on the New European that has a young boy on the front saying, I think it was like, enjoy your World Cup, my dad died for it. So it's a huge important issue. I'm not going to diminish it at all. I think... as the time has gone on, different issues have come to the fore. So as the stadiums were being built, that migrant worker issue really was being talked about it got, there was some big in-depth investigations. Sure, you're not wrong that we could have kept going on about it because it's appalling. I think, you know, we have raised the rights of both LGBT people in Qatar and, yes, the white visiting fans, because, you know, at the moment, they will be the ones, you know, people will have decided whether to go or not and where to stay because of those things. So I think all three things do matter and have been talked about. And frankly, they should be as it goes on.
Absolutely. I mean, I, as I say, I do not in any way want to diminish.
No, and you were, I understand.
It's just that my worry, and I remember thinking this about the film Pride. I love the film Pride. It's one of my favourite films. I saw it at an early preview and some of the cast were there, and I cried my heart out. And I remember the exact moment that I worked out why I don't know the main character, because obviously it's based on a real person. And I worked it out what had happened to him before it was revealed in the plot. And I just started sobbing. But Pride is often sold to us as a feel-good film, a film with a happy ending, because, hey, look, the Labour Party adopted gay rights. But for half of the people in Pride, there wasn't a happy ending. And their industry was completely devastated with nothing put in to support or replace it in their lives and communities. And their communities are still to this day suffering the effects of that. And I worry that we so often lose class-based arguments with a focus on identity-based arguments. And I hate the idea that these are being set up against each other. They shouldn't be, they are not. And one of the joys of Pride was the complete understanding of the solidarity between that working class movement and the LGBT movement. But I worry that we make it too easy for corporations, for example, who pay their staff abysmally and treat them appallingly,
to put a rainbow on things,
flag on it, and everything's all right. We're really progressing.
1 month a year, yeah,
exactly. So it's I don't know what the answer is. I just want to keep saying 6,500 people have died for this shit, and we shouldn't forget that.
It's an appropriately depressing note to end an appropriately depressing episode. I hope we come back next week feeling a bit more positive.
Can I give a tiny, tiny plug? Because although last week I said that my play was sold out, we've added a matinee on Saturday the 26th. So if people are desperate, there are a few, and I genuinely mean this. Everyone thinks I'm just hyper-marketing when I've got a handful of tickets left. But remember what happened last time I said that? We sold out. So there are about 30-odd tickets left for that matinee. We've already sold nearly half of them. So do get in if you want to come along.
There will be a link in the show notes to that. You're at @EmmaBurnell_ on the Twitters. I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on the Twitters. This is House of Comments, and I hope you'll join us next week.